So, Mark, how did you first become involved with the Church of Scientology?
I grew up in the Church of Scientology. My mother got involved when I was about 6 or 7 years old. And then I went to Scientology schools growing up and eventually went on to join their elite order called the Sea Organization when I was 16. And then I eventually worked at the international headquarters of Scientology for 15 years at their movie production facility.
So this really was your entire world for a great portion of your life when you were growing up.
Yeah, until I was in my early 30s. I was that's all I knew, and that was my entire world.
Huh. And at what point did you start working for the Church of Scientology?
When I was 16, in 1989.
And what sort of work did you do?
I did everything from manufacturing of cassettes and CDs of the recorded lectures that L. Ron Hubbard gave, to all the way up to being the executive producer for the movie studio facility that they have out in California.
Whoops, what was that? Was that on your end?
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
Yeah, that was on my end.
Okay. So, was that a normal path for kids like you who grew up in the Scientology church, that you grow up, you go to the Scientology schools, and then you wind up getting a job in some way with the church?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. For probably, I'd say, 50% of the kids that I went to school with ended up working for Scientology or Scientologists.
Wow, that's a really high...
After or even... Sorry.
That's a really high number. Why do you think that many?
Just because you're sort of indoctrinated, and you learn that basically anything and everything that you do for Scientology is the greatest good for the greatest number of people. And when you, so if you were to go out into the world and do something that had nothing to do with Scientology, or you weren't working for Scientologists, it's sort of viewed as you're a dilettante, or you're off chasing butterflies doing something else that doesn't forward the overall purpose of Scientology.
One of the big...
And
sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
So basically... when I was at the Scientology school, that is where I was recruited to come and work for Scientology and sign a billion-year contract. It was actually at the school itself. The recruiters came from the Scientology management facility, and that's where they recruited me to come and work for them. So it wasn't unusual for people that were, you know, going to a Scientology school or working for a Scientology company to be recruited to do this, you know, more on purpose, quote unquote, activity rather than, you know, doing whatever you were doing before that.
What do you mean you signed a billion-year contract? Literally?
Literally, when you join what's called the Sea Organization, which is it's basically the highest management corporation or the highest management company of Scientology, and it runs, the Sea Organization runs all of Scientology activities internationally. When you join the Sea Organization, you commit yourself to a billion years of service. And the idea is that even after this life, when you come back in future lives, you go back to work for the Sea Organization.
I hope they pay you well.
I worked there for over 15 years, and in 15 years, I earned an average of 30 cents an hour, and I worked 100-hour weeks for pretty much, you know, 52 weeks a year, 365 days a year, and I made a total of $29,000 over 15 years of working for them.
Is that
when
standard?
I left... That is absolutely a standard wage in the Sea Organization. When I left the Scientology and the Sea Organization and started my own company, I made more in the first 6 months on my own with no high school education than I made in 15 years working for them.
How did you even afford to live? Did they provide food and lodging?
They provide food and lodging. They spend very, very little on either of those things. And it's basically enough to get by. And yeah, medical is very kind of slipshod. Any other kind of support is, you know, you get what you can get. It's very dog eat dog. You know, if you needed contact lenses for your vision, you might end up on a list of 100 people and you could wait up to a year to get new contact lenses. That's the sort of, you know, environment, and the sort of support and care that they take for their members. And also when you become elderly, there are several people that I knew that had worked there for years and years and years. And when you become elderly and you're no longer useful, in most cases, they will what's called offload you from the Sea organization. And then you're basically on your own and they'll just dump you back with your family or anyone they can find to take care of you.
Now, you were working at this kind of secretive desert base, which is the company's headquarters. What exactly were you doing?
Well, I worked at their manufacturing and production studios called Golden Error Productions. And what we did was we produced all of the lectures, films, anything that was audiovisual related for Scientology is what we worked on and produced there. So I started out in the manufacturing department where they made the cassettes. And then with the advent of compact discs, we started making compact discs. I then moved onto the production facility where the films and videos were shot, promotional and educational films for Scientology. And I was the first assistant director for several years. Then I became the pre-production director, and then I eventually became the executive producer all over all of Golden Era Productions.
So you got up into the upper echelons of the Scientology organization. You also met Tom Cruise on more than one occasion and spent a fair amount of time with him, correct?
That's absolutely correct. Tom Cruise was, in Scientology, what they call an auditor, and I was his pre-clear, which is the person that's subject to the auditing.
What's an auditor?
So when an auditor is someone in Scientology who does processing, Scientology processing on somebody, and they have what they call the bridge to total freedom, and it has a processing side and it has a training side. And an auditor is someone who practices the processing on another person and moves them through all these different processes that could take anywhere from a month to a year to get through a certain step of this processing. And when Tom Cruise started as an auditor, he had to audit somebody. And that's the role that I played. I was the person that he was auditing on these very introductory and basic Scientology processing tasks that he did on me.
So he was training on you.
That's correct. I was kind of like his guinea pig.
So what did he do? What did this involve?
Basically, very introductory, what they're called training routines, and introductory auditing commands, where, you know, you're basically indoctrinating the person to be able to get audited and to do basic processing, and it's kind of a gradient approach to then you're going to then move on to doing more advanced processing on this person. But in order for them to be able to do that, they have to get through these rudimentary procedures and sort of get indoctrinated on how auditing and processing works in Scientology. So, I mean, that there's a lot of people that talk about, you know, in Scientology, some of these early things where you talk to an ashtray and you're walking over to them, touching walls and windows and stuff like that. And that's the sort of processing that he did on me.
Wait, you talk to an ashtray?
That's correct. You yell at an ashtray.
Why?
And
why?
It's to show you that you can have control over an object, and you can get the intention that you have in your mind. You can communicate it across a space into an object, it's you know, it's not that easy to explain in a few minutes.
Is the ashtray supposed to do something?
Well, you physically move the ashtray as you're yelling at it. So you tell the ashtray to stand up. You don't just use like a little, you know, small ashtray. You use a really big, like 8-inch by 8-inch thick glass ashtray, and you tell it to stand up, and then you lift it out of a chair, and then you tell it to sit down, and then you put it back in the chair. And this can go on for hours upon hours, day after day, until you can, you know, confidently and successfully do this on a routine basis.
Are you telling me that Tom Cruise sat with you for like hours and hours telling you to yell at an ashtray and then move it around the room and then tell it thank you?
That is exactly correct. We also played with books and bottles, and he asked me all sorts of questions, and we did a lot of this on the e-meter, which is a sort of a device, electric device they use in Scientology and in Scientology auditing and counseling. And it was very, very interesting, to say the least.
So I feel like we're running up against one of the big difficulties in talking about Scientology, and that is Scientology has its own, I guess, very advanced language. It's almost like you need a Scientology dictionary. I mean, this is interesting, but I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, I actually wrote a book on Scientology. It's actually been one of the best-selling books on Scientology for the last 3 years. And even though I included a glossary with the book, I do have many people comment on it to me that it is like its own language, and they have their own nomenclature and they have their own terminology, and they've made this their own little world, and it's very interesting on how you become indoctrinated to this world. And I've spoken to people that who have been in Scientology their entire life, and then they leave, and I speak to them maybe a year after they've left, and they still use the lingo, and they still speak in the certain Scientologies, if you will. And it's very hard to shake, and it takes a while, in most cases years, for people to kind of switch over and be able to live in the real world and not use the lingo and this whole sort of thing. And and there's actually support groups and websites and blogs that are at least 10 or 15 that I know of that are fully dedicated to that, where a lot of these people end up, and they kind of share their experiences and, you know, talk about all the crazy things they did in Scientology. And it is its own little world. And even the people that get out have their own little worlds.
Of course, that's kind of a classic description of a cult, right? You create a specialized language, and once you're in the cult, that's what you use. It's a kind of a method of controlling people. Were there other ways in which you felt controlled when you were in the Scientology community?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest things that Scientology does to control its members is when you're in Scientology, the longer you're in Scientology, the more everything in your life is Scientology related. So, you know, there's a lot of pressure to get family and friends in. There's a lot of pressure to use Scientology in your business dealings. Anything and everything in your life becomes connected in some way to Scientology. And then in order to leave, you either have to leave all that behind, or you have to get those people out of Scientology as well in order for you yourself to leave. So in my case, my mother, my sister, my half-brother, anybody that I knew, friends, family, lived with, worked with, anything, was in Scientology. So when I left in 2005, I had to literally start my life over from scratch, and I was not allowed to talk to any of my family members. So I have not spoken with my sister since 2005. My brother, my wife, who also eventually, very shortly after I left, came and left with me as well. And she hasn't spoken to her parents, her sisters, her brother, anyone involved with Scientology, because they're forbidden to speak with us. And a very interesting comment was, we went to a family reunion, and my mother actually told her family, which are not in Scientology, that the reason that she couldn't speak with us is because it would jeopardize the future of all mankind's eternity. That was the reason why she couldn't speak to me. That was the reason why she hadn't seen her only two grandsons. That was the, you know, this is this control factor. So a lot of people that are in Scientology that no longer believe in it, or have disagreements, or for one reason or another no longer want to stay in Scientology, they have no choice, because their sister or brother or mother or father or son or daughter are all in Scientology, and they basically have to leave their entire family. And if your family's not in it, you might have a Scientology boss, or you might work at a Scientology company, so you'd have to get a new job, or, you know, possibly lose your house, or, you know, there's so many ramifications for some of these people that try to leave that they just can't, and they just stay just and play nice just so they can live their life and not have their entire life destroyed by speaking out or trying to leave Scientology.
So when you were still in the Scientology community and, you know, working and fairly at a fairly high level, did you believe all the Scientology teachings, or were you just going through the motions? I mean, for example, did you believe the idea that a human is an immortal alien, known as a thetan?
Well, I grew up in it, so I didn't know anything else. I didn't know any better. I didn't know anything differently. And when you're in Scientology, you're pretty much indoctrinated that Scientologists are a smarter, more advanced, you know, breed of person, and that you're better than everyone else. So that if anybody else said this is the way it was, and it was contrary to Scientology, then you would just look down on it and be like, oh, they're crazy. So
if a public school teacher said, no, that's not true, you would think, well, she's an idiot.
That's right. They actually call it, they call it homo, or you're just homo sapiens. You're a lower level of human, and you're just not advanced, and you don't know these things. And they often frown upon, you know, psychiatrists and psychologists. And, you know, one of the things I learned when I was there is that pretty much everybody in the real world, or what they call the WOG world, is anything outside of Scientology is referred to as the WOG world.
Does WOG stand for anything?
I think it stands for worldly oriented gentleman, but I don't know the derivation of the word, but it's a derogatory term used in Scientology to refer to anyone who is not a Scientologist. They call them WOGs.
You also had a fair amount of contact with the Church of Scientology's leader, David Miscavige. Is that right?
That's correct.
Did I say his name correctly?
Yeah, Miscavige. Okay. He pronounces it Miscavige.
Okay. What did you think? What did you think of him? What's he like?
Well, I really never had anyone to compare him to until I left. And I saw a documentary on Jonestown, and that's the only person that I've ever seen or heard about that I think would most closely match him in terms of being very charismatic and being someone who can convince people to do things and who rub shoulders with the politicians and the celebrities and then, you know, pass out the Kool-Aid. That's the only thing or person I could really compare him to, just because he is a tyrant. I've seen him physically assault the Scientology's most highest executives.
I've
written about a lot of these things, and Scientology.
Assault how?
Yeah, they've denied it, and they've you know, said, oh, these are all lies. And then eventually more and more people who had also witnessed these abuses started coming out and then telling their stories. And they were all exactly the same. Yes, David Miscavige, he slaps people, punches people, hits them, throws them to the ground, all these insane things. And literally I was at a certain point when I kind of decided that I really needed to expose what I knew and basically tell as much as I could, was after I'd seen this documentary on Jonestown, because I truly believe if they passed out the Kool-Aid tomorrow, that the people that I worked with would drink it in a second. And I just thought, this is crazy. This is, you know, how is this possible that this could be happening in a modern day group and society? So
there's, you write about,
yeah, it's very crazy.
There's one really weird episode you describe, involving some kind of a sort of perversion of the musical chairs game that David Miscavige used.
That's correct. We were basically assembled by David Miscavige, and we were told that we were going to play a game of musical chairs, and essentially whoever lost a chair was going to be shipped off to far corners of the world to do menial and demeaning jobs in Scientology organizations, and like cigarette butt cleaner upper and, you know, toilet scrubbing in charge and sort of things like this. And as people lost chairs and were separated from their wives or their husbands, and it was a very dramatic, insane episode that occurred. And it went on for hours, and eventually one woman was the one left, and David Miscavige said, okay, good, you can stay here and work with me, and everybody else is out of here. And he went so as far to have plane tickets printed up for people so that they knew he wasn't joking. They were absolutely being shipped off to, you know, wherever it was to do these very, very demeaning punishments for could be years on end. And then the next morning it was like it never happened. And he was like, oh no, it's going to cost too much money to ship you guys all over the place, so I'm not going to do anything. No one's going anywhere. And when I first wrote about this, Scientology categorically denied that it ever occurred, that anything like that ever happened, and that I was lying, and, you know, I was a crazy, disgruntled apostate. I think that's what they called me. And I did write about it in a book.
Did you actually witness the book?
I was there. I was one of the people. I fought with a gentleman named Marty Rathbun over a chair, and I think I ended up throwing him to the ground to get the chair over him sitting in it. And eventually other people came out, and the other people that were there and witnessed the exact same thing told pretty much the exact same thing that I had already told in excruciating detail. And the church, the Scientology organization, admitted that yes, it did happen, and that David Miscavige was trying to teach the executives of Scientology a lesson. And it's funny that's one of hundreds of things that I detail that have happened in my book, Blown for Good, Behind the Iron Curtain of Scientology. And when that book first came out, Scientology categorically denied pretty much anything and everything in the book. And since its release in 2009, they've pretty much either on the record, in press responses to press, in response to other former members coming forward, they've pretty much admitted that every single thing that I've said actually did occur. And it was either ecclesiastical justice or David Miscavige teaching his employees a lesson, or, you know, it was part of their scriptures, quote unquote, or practices. I mean, the 180 they've done is pretty unbelievable in terms of it absolutely didn't happen to David Miscavige was trying to teach somebody a lesson. So,
Mark, by far the most dramatic story you tell in the book is the story of your own departure from the Church of Scientology. You literally had to escape, and people came after you. Can you tell the story?
Yeah, well, in addition to them just not letting you leave in the first place, between the barbed wire fences and the, you know, armed guards, etc. If you do, in fact, manage to escape, in my case, they chased me down in a security SUV, and I was fleeing the property on a motorcycle, and I was driving down the road, and after them repeatedly nudging me or yelling out the window for me to pull over or to return to the property, they essentially just ran me off the road, just slowly nudged me over as we were driving, and there was, you know, no more shoulder left, and I crashed the motorcycle. The security officer that was driving the vehicle got out of the vehicle, grabbed the key out of my bike, and basically insisted that I return to the property, get in the SUV, and they were taking me back. At that point, I waved down passing motorists, and the security guard threw the key to my motorcycle back to me, and I sort of gathered myself and got the bike. The bike was slightly damaged, and within minutes of me getting kind of back on the road, they continued to follow me, and then they just turned around and drove back. And 10 seconds, 30 seconds later, a Riverside County Sheriff's Department vehicle pulled me over, and they had a 911 call that there was some gentlemen fighting on the highway. And basically the police escorted me to safety into the nearby town. And that is the only reason that I was able to escape. If those police would not have shown up when they did, I would be there to this day. I almost am certain of it. And I would have never been allowed to leave, especially after you've attempted an escape or you've escaped and been recovered. Those people are very heavily guarded and watched for sometimes decades, more closely than anybody else, because they've left before. And there's a rule in Scientology, and that's if you've left once, you'll leave again. So they definitely pay close attention to your whereabouts and what you're up to and what you're doing. So,
well, you're...
Yeah, there's actually, if you just Google Mark Headley police report, and it's also included in the book, the printed police reports from the Riverside Sheriff's Department.
But the
Riverside Sheriff's deputies themselves.
You're talking about armed guards, barbed wire fences, being under surveillance. Were you actually imprisoned?
I like to call it that. And I think that... When I wrote the book, Blown for Good, I say behind the Iron Curtain of Scientology, because that's really what it is. It's like you've got this little area of Gilman Hot Springs, California, which is heavily guarded. They have barbed wire motion sensors on the fences. It's razor wire. It's, if you climb over the fence at Golden Era Productions, you will go to the hospital afterwards. There, it's almost impossible to get over without getting sliced up. You're not allowed to go anywhere on your own. If you say I'm going to leave the property, then they will descend upon you and say, "Let's go. We need to talk," or "Let's sort this out." You can't just walk out of there. And of course, is anytime somebody who's left says any of this, they say, "Oh, we have," they'll immediately churn out 100 affidavits from people that work there saying, "Oh, it's the most wonderful place in the world. It's like Disneyland here." Although, you know, there are teams and teams of people that have left that have spoken out and said, "Yes, this is what happens there." And they just say, "Oh, it's, those guys are just disgruntled. They're just disgruntled ex-members." The last I checked, the list of disgruntled ex-members from Scientology was up to about 1,800 people. And those are the ones that are willing to speak out. There's probably twice or three times that many who've left that are, you know, too afraid or they've been intimidated and they wouldn't, you know, dare speak out against the Scientologists.
Now, of course, when you got out, your wife, Claire, was still with the church, still back on that compound, right?
That's correct. When I left, I had attempted to go and see her to tell her that I was going to leave. And she had been up all night actually trying to convince another woman whose husband had left that woman needed to stay, and which is, you know, ironic. And I couldn't speak with her, so I ended up leaving. And then they used her to try and convince me to come back. And, you know, by this time I had slept and eaten and, you know, realized there was a whole world outside of Scientology that was far saner and far more productive and easier to get along and work with than anyone I'd worked with at Scientology. And I basically told her, you got to get out of there. You're never going to believe how, you know, how much better it is outside of that place. And so she also left, and they also intercepted her. I mean, she was cornered in a Las Vegas bus station hundreds of miles from the Scientology compound by two of its highest executives, and they attempted to intercept her and bring her back. And luckily, you know, she resisted that and was able to get away. And, you know, we've been together ever since, and we've got, you know, two awesome young children and another one on the way. And we wish we would have left sooner, but, you know, it is what it is. And we're out now and we're living our lives.
Has that mostly been a good experience, or has the church tried to retaliate in any way?
Oh, Scientology's done just about anything and everything they could do to make our lives miserable. We've had private investigators digging through our trash and camped outside our house and making trouble at my businesses and anywhere I've worked, companies I've owned. They've done it all. I recently read a story which kind of made me feel a little bit better, but there was a gentleman who left who was David Miscavige's, basically his rival. And David Miscavige essentially ousted him, this other gentleman by the name of Pat Broker, from the Scientology's leadership. And they've spent over $10 million on private investigators, and they've been watching this Pat Broker character for 25 years. They've been watching this guy. They've spent millions of dollars on private investigators. So the fact that they've only spent 7 years hiring private investigators to follow me around and keep tabs on me kind of, you know, is like, I'm just small potatoes compared to
there are millions more they could be spending on you.
I couldn't believe it. But they're slowly but surely losing all of the intimidation tactics and the pull they have is, you know, it is what it is. They have a lot of money. They have billions of dollars. And when people ask me, you know, about them following me, or, you know, I just say, listen, if you had $1 billion, how much would you spend to keep it? And that's essentially what you've got with Scientology. If you've got a gentleman out there who knows secrets about David Miscavige, and he could possibly leak him, well, spending $10 million on private investigators to keep your eyes on him is a small price to pay to keep that billion-dollar empire going. So,
well, Mark, thanks for surviving to tell the story.
Well, yeah, thanks for having me. And, if anybody wants to know more, they can pick up the book. It's on Amazon. You can get it on Kindle or any other thing. But I do detail a lot of my experiences and a lot of the things that happened at the international headquarters in the book. And just doing what I can to expose what I know.
Thank you. Thanks very much. That's fascinating.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Okay, great.